Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's Great Conversation is with Chrissy Neen. Chrissy is the award-winning author of Affection. Her 2017 novel An Uncertain Grace was shortlisted for the Stella Prize, and her latest novel Wintering transports the reader to the southernmost parts of Tasmania and into the darkness of our soul. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I speak with an Australian writer and explore their books, writing, literary culture as I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. The Great Conversations podcast lets me enlarge that discussion and get behind the scenes of the book, explore the pressing issues and how they relate to our world. Now, thank you to everyone who has shared the Great Conversations podcast with friends. The best way to get the word out about great Australian writing is to subscribe, rate and share the podcast. If you're enjoying Great Conversations, why not share it with two friends? Maybe they're podcast lovers, maybe they're book lovers. By sharing it with them, you can increase the circle of people that love Australian writing and have a few new friends to discuss books with. Now, today on the show, we're talking Wintering with Chrissy Neen. Wintering takes us into the lives of Jessica and Matthew. They live a secluded life in an out-of-the-way cabin in Tasmania's south. Matthew's a local, though, in a town that knows what you had for breakfast before the coffee even gets cold, while Jessica's from the mainland and mostly keeps to herself. Life goes on, as life tends to do, until one evening Matthew fails to return home and Jessica receives a call. The police have found his car and his phone abandoned on an isolated section of road. Join me as I explore Wintering in conversation with Chrissy Neen. I am Andrew Popel, and I am just ecstatic to be joined on the line by Chrissy Neen. I last spoke with Chrissy on Final Draft around the release of The Adventures of Holly White and The Incredible Sex Machine. It was a few years back now. Chrissy's last novel, An Uncertain Grace, was shortlisted for the Stella Prize, and her latest novel is Wintering, and that's what we're going to be discovering today. Chrissy, welcome. I confessed off air how much I've loved Wintering, so this is going to be a fun chat.
Oh, thanks, Andrew. Lovely to be here.
Now, Wintering transports the reader down, we're sort of in the southernmost parts of Tasmania, and we go into the lives of Jessica and Matthew. They live a secluded life in an out-of-the-way cabin. Matthew's a local, though, in a town that knows what you had for breakfast before the coffee even gets cold, while Jessica mostly keeps to herself, completing a PhD on, if I get this right, the light variation and the circadian rhythms of glowworms.
That's right.
Yeah. And so life goes on, as life tends to do, until one evening Matthew fails to return home and Jessica receives a call. The police have found his car and his phone abandoned on an isolated section of road. Now, before we get too far into the narrative, I wanted to put sort of an inverted commas spoiler alert. We are not going to be discussing any of the tantalizing twists of the plot that you weave through Wintering. However, in discussing the themes, we may end up hinting at things being more than they seem. So, to the listener, be warned and make sure you go and get your copy of Wintering right now. I'll forgive you if you want to pause and run to the bookstore. So, Chrissy, this is a remarkable novel. And I think if fans of your work know one thing, it's that you will always produce something really innovative and unexpected. I mean, to jump from something like Holly White and The Incredible Sex Machine to Wintering is a big difference. But what I'm really interested in is this. I have this love of novels set in Tasmania, and I'm curious, what took you down to the Apple Isle for Wintering?
Well, look, I do a lot of my writing down there, actually. My dad lives down there. We went on a motorcycle trip many years ago now, and we discovered Tasmania together, rode around for 3 weeks, and within 2 weeks, I think, after we'd gotten back to Brisbane, Dad called me and said, I've bought a place and I'm moving down. And I think that he fell in love with it that much during that motorcycle trip. And I've been visiting him ever since. And I go a couple of times a year. And there's actually a poet who lives down in Southport, right down the south of Tasmania, who my dad has met and befriended. And she loves for me to go down and stay in her shack down there. So it actually is the setting for this book is the shack that I write in at least once or twice a year.
I saw that in your dedication. So this is the shack that may or may not be in the book, right?
It is. It's sort of like a parallel world of the shack, a creepier version.
I kind of loved the shack as creepy as it may get, because it's so self-sustained and so kind of wonderful. You feel like you could go and escape and create a novel or create anything, create yourself.
It's such a wonderful place to work from. It's right on the water. It's just a little weatherboard shack. It's really open to the elements, but there's a fireplace there. And so, you know, all you can do in winter is really stoke the fire and sit at the beautiful view, which just opens to the water, and just watch the whales go by. It's fantastic.
Mm. Now, I think most readers will know, though, that isolation in a narrative is a double-edged sword. And as the novel sort of builds in its action, I noticed early in the book that Jessica and Matthew's relationship could have these quite strained moments. There is the isolation. There's Jessica's reliance on Matthew. He's a local. She's not. He's also, we see in the first, sort of few pages, he can be a bit emotionally changeable. And so as I was reading, it was only a few pages in, I noticed these are sort of traits that we can come to understand under terms like gaslighting. Was this intentional really on in the book for the reader, or do you think we're at a place where people can just notice these subtle warning signs in relationships?
Look, for me it was intentional. Like, I really wanted it to, look at those issues of when somebody is in a relationship that's domestic violence but doesn't look like that. From the inside, because I've known a lot of people who've lived with partners who are quite controlling or damaging and haven't realised that from the inside. But I did want to show that she's in a relationship that's not, it's not all it's cracked up to be, really. It's something that is dangerous in itself.
I think one of the things that you really showed me also was that the hardest part, and I guess coming at this as a man, this is something hard to sort of confront as a feature of masculinity, but this idea that the situation is created such that the person who's having this done to them is made to feel like they're not really thinking about it in the right way. Jessica is deeply in love with Matthew, and she ultimately puts a lot of it back on herself.
Yeah, I think that is quite common. I think people who are in those kind of controlling relationships do take responsibility for the problems within the relationship quite often, at least the ones that I've been, privy to. It's often the woman in that relationship who's kind of going, it must be my fault, I'm doing something wrong. They're apologising for themselves the whole time. It just seems to be quite a common trait. And I think that it's a cultural thing. We see our mothers do it. We see our mothers apologise for their taking up space in the world, and that continues to be perpetrated from generation to generation. So it was something that was really at the front of my mind when I was writing this book, that Jessica's a very capable woman, but even though she's a very capable woman, she's in this relationship which has removed some of her power from her.
You also, I found you infected me with what I guess I came to assume is the sort of paranoia that women must walk around with every day. After seeing even the most subtle sort of exertion of control against her, I came to be really suspicious of all the male characters and their motivations. Is this an aspect of Jessica's point of view, or were you also trying to create kind of an every woman's experience of the world?
It's a bit of both. She's a stranger in a strange town, I suppose. So there is an element of her not knowing the ways of the local people. So there's an element of her not knowing how to interpret the kind of gruff pragmatism of some of the locals. And so for her, she finds them frightening, even if they are not necessarily threatening her. Mm. And I think that's something that I definitely feel as a woman, and particularly when I go and do my writing down in the south of Tasmania, because you're there in somebody else's world. There are people who live there full-time. I don't know them. I haven't made an effort to connect with them because I go down there for the isolation. And so for me, that kind of feeling of being an outsider, I always get this feeling because I've got these glasses that I wear, that, you know, my partner and I, and we both wear glasses, are always kind of like, oh yes, they are the city folk coming down and having a beer at the pub. We're always sort of looked at a bit strangely. So there's an element of that stranger in a strange town, and not quite sure whether the fact that you're picked as being an other in that place is a dangerous thing or not, I suppose. But it also is a factor of being a woman too. You know, you can't, as a woman, you can't walk around at night without being aware of every single man in, you know, viewing distance, and just, you know, sizing them up and working out whether it's a threat to you or not. And that's a terrible thing to have to kind of, you know, spend every second of your life judging whether you're going to be hurt by someone.
And exhausting, I can imagine, you do, to be constantly vigilant.
Yeah, it's terrible. Mm. And it shouldn't have to happen. But unfortunately, we still live in a society where that still does happen.
Mm. I wanted also to ask about pets and the relationship that we have with animals. Now, as I was preparing, I read the interview you recently did with Ben Law. So I know that you have a cat. I have cats. I love cats. throughout wintering, there is, though, this sort of dark tension between the human and the non-human world. Jessica, in particular, she seems to suffer at the idea of her glowworm population. We haven't sort of talked about that, but she's doing her PhD in this marvelous cave system exploring the life cycles of glowworms. And how they're impacted by human intervention. There's also Brutus, and that sort of whole, what happens there is it feels a little bit too raw to discuss. That was that was a really affecting scene.
Yeah. Oh, look, I grew up with animals, and I grew up in a family that almost, well, probably I could say they do value animals more than humans. So the family that I grew up with, my mother rescues birds, and, you know, nurses them back to health, and some of them will be caged forever because they can't fly. I grew up with dogs. I slept in the bed with a dog as a child. I've had a really intimate relationship with animals all my life, and I also see that that's kind of an important thing because, you know, we are so separated from the natural world that we are less aware of climate change and the impact that we are having on the environment because we are, you know, disconnected from animals, and we don't see that we are causing these mass extinctions on lots of different levels. You know, like tiny little creatures are, their populations are changing, and it's because of climate change and because of our impact. So I think that, you know, our relationship with animals is one that we need to treat with a degree of respect, really, because it's teaches us so much about our place in the natural world.
Yeah, I was really curious with the way you explored that because on the one sense, I guess you play around with this idea. We know there's a lot in the psychological literature about individual violence towards animals and the really nasty connotations that can have for individual character. But we can be so dismissive at these large-scale climatic or even sort of at a forest level events that would cause untold deaths of animals. Can you talk a little bit? I mean, I know that we're sort of getting very close to the mystery of wintering, but can you talk a little bit about how that plays into the particular environment of Tasmania? Because you do get deep into the forest on several occasions, and you have characters that have a long history going back to the logging days of that area.
Yeah, I think Tasmania is a really great example of where we can really see our impact really clearly on the natural world. We are still, you know, logging great areas of Tasmania, and yet it's, you know, the main kind of resource and the main richness of the area is its kind of nature and the animal life there. It's a place where those battles are still playing out between the people who want to conserve what we have, the natural world, and those that just treat it as a resource for us to kind of log or cut or sell off for, you know, pulp. So I think that space is an area where I do kind of see that very clearly. But it's also an area that when I'm down in the south of Tasmania, I get this incredible sense that we don't belong there. Mm. Whenever I'm down there, I feel like the forest is closing ranks against us. There are areas of Tasmania that I go to where, you know, I'll be driving through the road that goes through really heavily forest acreage, and you can just see the bars on your mobile phone going down to zero. Then you know, you see that SOS only sign on your phone, which really reminds you that you might need an emergency call at any moment, and that's all you can do from down there. And then it goes completely, you know, because the forest has closed in around you. There is no way that any kind of a phone signal could get down there. And those are the areas that I feel we are the invaders when we're down there. It doesn't feel like we should be in those spaces. Those spaces feel like wild and natural places. And I always think about the traditional owners of that land and the fact that they would know the places to avoid, and they would know the places where they're welcome. But because we, you know, invaded so brutally and so cruelly into that area, you know, as non-Aboriginal people, we are not wanted. And it's really clear, you know, that we're kind of, we're in a battle with the natural world. So I think, you know, I was really trying to kind of grapple with those ideas when I was writing this book. And yeah, so nature versus human is quite a strong theme.
That is such a remarkable horror movie scene you've also described, descending into the forest. And I could almost imagine the visual of the bars disappearing on the phone to kind of a descending chord. And it sounds like, when you describe it, it sounds like it should be ridiculous, but that really is something for a cosmopolitan Australian. That's something of a horror story. And then to be in a space where we feel we are intruding, but then this sense that there's something to intrude on. I mean, in Tasmania, we have the sort of the coming and going appearances of the thylacine, you know, the Tasmanian tiger that we can't quite come to grips with its extinction. I mentioned before that I've fallen in love with Tasmanian novels and obsessed with them this year. Another one that I really loved was Robbie Arnott's Flames, which is also from Text Publishing. And both of you touch into the world, but also that there's a mystery and there is a presence there beyond what we understand. Do you have a sense of your books?
Yeah, I read Robbie's book and I saw all those kind of parallels and thought, oh, look, we're kind of thinking in the same way, really, that it's kind of a space where you feel like the other paranormal kind of mysterious myths, legends can just slip into those kind of very forested areas and hide there. It feels a little bit like you're getting past, you know, the science and the civilization that we've come to kind of rely on as this safe space. And you kind of enter this world where science is meaningless because it's so thickly forested. It's so much a natural world that resists the science. So, you know, for me, science is a really amazing way of explaining the world. And that idea that anything that is now science was once considered magic is, you know, that was foremost in my mind when I was writing this book, this kind of line that anything that you don't understand slips into the world of myth and magic. And I wanted to kind of play with the idea that this book exists on that very defined line between where science ends and magic begins. So Wintering really is about what happens when you kind of reach that edge and you tip into a world where you can't explain what's happening, and your mind just reaches for those kind of basic kind of myths and legends and ideas of magic and the other.
A very spoilery question just occurred to me that I might save till we're off air, because I wanted to explore also the individual and the relationship to community. And I hadn't considered also the sense of the broader environmental community that we've just been discussing, but very much in Wintering, we have this community that I think cosmopolitan readers can't fully appreciate, that's these support networks that can so quickly become stifling. There's the group of women that come to Jessica's aid after Matthew's disappearance, that are as much a curse as a blessing. Did this reflect your own experiences of community? You've talked about your time in Tasmania. What were you exploring here?
I really love the women that are central to this book, the group of local women who all believe their partners have all disappeared, just as Jessica's partner disappears. And they believe that something supernatural has happened to their partners, and they want to convince Jessica to join them in their kind of crazy beliefs. And for me, those women, they're just so capable. They cut their own wood. They tend to their own property. They fish from the ocean. They are incredibly capable women, and yet here they are, kind of having these beliefs which we could consider crazy, really. And I love the idea that that these women are so self-reliant, and in a way they've got their feet deeply rooted in that land, even though they are, they're not Aboriginal women, they're Western women. They have learnt that land, and they have kind of wedded their lives to it so carefully that, they almost survive against the odds in a land that's quite harsh to their needs. And so I love that kind of, that line where they're incredibly capable, and yet they create their own logic within that space that kind of gets twisted and turned and becomes something that seems unrecognizable from the outside. They have their own internal logic, those women. And Jessica kind of, she's just pushed into their company, and she struggles with their ideas because, she's from somewhere else and she's not from there. So, yeah, I think that they're a vital part of the book, and they were the most fun that I had writing the book, I think, was writing those women, because I know some women like that. I know women who are a little bit crazy, but who are incredibly good at surviving and, finding their own community within that. And I think we all know people like that who can kind of find that incredible sense of strange otherworldliness and yet survival at the same time.
Do you think the resilience and the unique perspective are inextricably entwined? Like, do you think something about viewing the world in that way has helped them become resilient and to survive?
Well, I think that distrust of the world that they have, the distrust of what everybody else says is right, is a part of that survivalist kind of way of living. You can't, if you just kind of give in and just trust, the authorities, or trust the government, and trust the scientists, you're kind of giving away some of your power in a way, because you're actually relaxing into letting other people make those decisions for you. But these women, they insist that their views are the right way to see the world, even though it doesn't kind of fit the norm. And they're staunch in kind of sticking by their views despite anyone else who might think that they're crazy. And so there's something incredibly resilient about sticking to your guns and believing what you believe. It also leads to a lot of trouble, because you need a balance between distrust and trust, otherwise you can't exist in the world. But there has to be a level of critical thinking, I suppose, and distrust of what other people say is truth. I don't know. It's just there's something about that kind of allows a flexibility and allows a survival when other people may not. Other people might think, because they're just solely relying on others to make the decisions for them.
Yeah. There's something maybe... I thought maybe there's something novelistic about it too, the way we, for a period when we read, we dive into a world and we immerse ourselves in it, no matter what the circumstances of it are. And how would that look if you writ that large across your entire life and allowed the circumstances of a different sort of story to be your world?
Yeah, that's true. And I also think, you know, sometimes we get stuck in this way that we believe something is right. We have this one vision of the world, and so therefore everything sort of slots in place with this vision of the world. But if you kind of look at it from a different cultural perspective, for instance, you know, you kind of go to a different country with a very, very different cultural perspective, your way of looking at the world suddenly seems crazy. And things that you would think are crazy are suddenly the norm and their way of looking at the world. And, you know, it's not that one is right or one is wrong. It's just that as a community we have agreed on ways of looking at the world, and that you've just slipped into a community you don't understand, and suddenly it seems crazy, but it's a way of interpreting the world that is just unfamiliar to you. And, you know, it's like if you look from the perspective of an ant, you'll see the world in one way. And if you look from a perspective of a monkey, you'll see the world in a different way. And if you look from the perspective of a human, you'll see it in a different way too. So, you know, it really depends on where you sit in that ecosystem as to how you're going to see the world.
And we are discussing this plurality of perspective in relation to Chrissy Neen's Wintering. I'm joined by Chrissy right now. We've been discussing just so much about the book and yet so little about the mystery. I want everyone to go out and discover this, Chrissy. And you're going to be up in Sydney in a couple of weeks, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I'm going to be at Better Ed Than Dead, hanging out with Benjamin Law, wonderful Benjamin Law.
On October 5th, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So it's going to be fun. Benjamin and I go a long way back, and it'll be really great fun chatting to him there.
I'm going to encourage everyone to get along with that because I know, well, Chrissy, we've just had a chat. I know what a great conversationalist you are. Ben is also an amazing conversationalist, so that's going to be a fabulous evening. Thank you so much for coming and discussing Wintering on Final Draft.
No worries, Andrew. Thanks for that.
That's it for this great conversation with Chrissy Neen. Chrissy's new novel, Wintering, is out now through Text Publishing. Great Conversations is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation at 2SER's Broadway Studios in Sydney, Australia. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. If you're enjoying Great Conversations from Final Draft, hit subscribe in iTunes or wherever you're getting your podcasts, and you'll receive a new episode delivered straight to your phone every week. Don't forget to share the podcast with friends. And if you're enjoying it, please rate us. Help others discover this world of Australian literature. If you want to keep up with the latest books, writing and literary culture, why not follow us on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook? Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. My name is Andrew Popel. I'll be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft.